Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to A Time for Justice. Thank you all for calling and listening to the Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice. I am your host, Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am an attorney. This show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion of legal minds. And I also have our co-host, which is Sister Nichelle Muhammad. Sister Judge Nichelle Muhammad is our co-host, and she will join us in a minute. As we said, the show discusses this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. Our guest tonight will not make those excuses for racist conduct, which really is a distraction from the truth. And we know the truth is a path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. Again, my name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am an attorney, and I'm opening up the mic and bringing on Sister Judge Nichelle Muhammad. Sister Judge Nichelle, assalamu alaikum, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. Wa alaikum salam, Sister Pamela. Thank you, ma'am. And in my day, I was an attorney, too. Happen to be a judge right now. Thankful for Allah's blessing. I want to say we know there's no God but Allah, and that Muhammad is his messenger. And I want to say greetings tonight in our original tongue of Arabic. We say it as Assalamu alaikum and happy Savior's Day to all of our sisters and brothers that have joined us here today, within or without the Nation of Islam. You're a part of this family. So I want a welcome evening, and we're going to talk about something near and dear to our nation's heart. The minister, our Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, when we talk about making our community a safe and decent place to be, I believe these sisters are doing that, and we're going to hear from them tonight. All praise is due to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. Praise is due to Allah. And thank you, Judge Nichelle. You always bring such a wonderful perspective to the show. You are the judge on the show, and as in court, you know, what the judge says goes, y'all. And
yes,
that's just a little humor for right. A Time for Justice. But, you know, we love you and we value your contribution, Sister Judge Nichelle. And we also have to remind our listeners that, you know, we still want to lift up the name and the memory of our sister, Dr. Ava Muhammad, as the final call on September the 13th referred to her as a fearless defender, scholar, and believer, our beloved sister who made her transition. And we just love her. As quoted, you know, Sister Ava, it is said that her strength as a strong defender of truth and the plight of Black people came from her profound love. She used the skills she acquired as a former prosecuting attorney in Queens, New York, and she brought that same proficiency against our open enemy. And that's a quote directly from our brother Mustafa. and that is in the final call, September the 13th, 2022. And, you know, I would like to, again, I want to go ahead and introduce our topic for tonight. Our topic is entitled Uniting Our Efforts to Give Our Youth a Fair Chance. And I think, again, thinking about Sister Ava, we know that she loved the children and she loved the Black family. So, again, just wanted to lift her up and continue to keep her family in our prayers. And so let me go ahead and open up the mic. We have some wonderful guests. Sister Judge Michelle, as always, brings it and has a wide reach of people all over the country. And so we thank her for many of the guests that she brings to the show. The first person I would like to introduce, and I want to make sure that those guests have their hands up and that they are actually pressed the number one to get into the host queue, so I can acknowledge the guest and bring you all right into this panel discussion. And so our first guest, her name is Joanne L. Dunn Francis. And Miss Francis, our sister, is a director, executive director of a youth shelter in Mount Vernon, New York. She is also a worker, I believe, Sister Michelle, in the Emerging Adults Justice program, which is in the courts, yes, the city court of Mount Vernon, and that particular program actually works with youth who are 18 to 25. Our sister, Ms. Dunn Francis, she brings such a wide range of experience over 15 years, as she has been a volunteer in the community. Our sister has, she said, volunteer relentless hours to various community projects, youth and family outreach programs, cultural and religious and holiday events. Our sister has been the recipient, our sister Joanne Dunn Francis has been the recipient of countless awards for her service to the community, including services to youth and family in the community. And so I just really am only doing a small version of all of the accomplishments that our beautiful sisters bring to the panel, but I did want to highlight some, and we're going to give our sister an opportunity to speak for herself. So let me go ahead and open up the mic, and I'm going to ask Ms. Dunn to identify herself, because I do think I have her mic open. Yes, Sister Joanne.
I'm here. Good afternoon. Dunn-Francis. Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me? Good evening.
Yes, ma'am.
I can hear you.
Good evening. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to be here, and I am humbly grateful that Sister Michelle Muhammad invited me to be here and just to bring my experiences and also share the voices of young people who are involved in the justice system. And so I'm here as a prop to really elevate the voices of young people who are living in this turmoil every day and involved in the justice system. The Youth Shelter Program of Westchester is one of its kind in New York State and in Westchester County, New York. We are the only alternative to incarceration program that is working with young people ages 18 to 24 who are in the criminal court system. And a part of my work is not only to, you know, we use this term a lot about restorative justice, and I know we're going to get there, so I'm not going to go too deep in my intro, but I think your conversation or our conversation tonight in regards to a time for justice is when are we going to talk about making sure that we're providing age-appropriate solutions to justice for young people and making sure that we're really applying a racial equity lens to that across the board. And so I'm really delighted to be here, delighted to bring my lived work experience and along with bringing the voices of young people who every day I work with are caught up in the in the system or in the turmoil of the justice system. And so thank you for having me tonight, and I hope that I can share some nuggets of information that people can take with them to really disrupt, destroy, and dismantle the system.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much for that, sister. I really do appreciate it. And so let me go ahead and open up the mic to the next person I have on the list. And I do have the mic open for our sister, Dr. Tracy Alexander. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce Dr. Tracy Alexander, who serves as a social justice leader working with Boys and Girls Club of America. Dr. Alexander has been a prominent media pioneer, award-winning journalist, and professional in the field of communication and leadership development for over 30 years. She works in fundraising, business development, and has been dedicated to advancing social justice for women of color and to support underserved and marginalized communities. So I'm going to let Dr. Alexander talked to us more about some of her accomplishments. I do want to note that she, early in her career, was the first black woman to anchor the evening news for ABC in Central Louisiana. So I just wanted to add that. But Dr. Alexander? Yes, ma'am. Greetings to
amen,
you, sister. How
amen.
Are you?
Amen, as we say. We just simply say amen. I receive that. I receive that, Sister Pam. I receive that, Sister Michelle and Sister Joanne, my soror. Good evening, good evening. It is truly a joy and an honor, and it's a gift for me to be here on this line with you this evening. I'm going to ask for grace in advance. I am fired up as I am sitting here on Amtrak traveling from Washington, D.C. back home to New York. I say that because I just left a very powerful and impactful summit for America's youth that was organized by the Boys and Girls Club of America. And our guest speaker was First Lady Jill Biden, along with the CEO of Boys and Girls Club of America. And it was a small group of us to really address this very same issue. So as I can just simply say to you, oh, we're right on time. We're right on time. And I also am coming off the heels of watching last night The Woman King. So all I can say is allow me to exhale. And Sister Pam, I just want to say one thing. I don't want to talk about my accomplishments, because what's most important is the work that we are doing and the work that we need to do. So I just want to stay in that moment, if you will allow me. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Sister Alexander. And I want to say, too, that I think sorority acknowledgments are in order, because I, too, am a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, so just want to make sure. But I just wanted to add that in.
Yes,
yes, okay. All right. And so let me bring on with no further delay, I want to bring in another close personal friend of mine who is also a part of this panel tonight, and her name is Dr. Deborah Green. And Dr. Green is the president of the Black Child Development Institute in the Houston branch. Dr. Green brings a long history of work experience in a child welfare, child abuse prevention. She was actually the work supervisor, program director, state office director, and a juvenile justice liaison, and that is in the state of Texas. She's focused on the area of disproportionality and positive family outcomes, which have led her to do some books and articles and publications. So just wanted to put that out there for our Dr. Green, and I want to go ahead and open up the mic to her. Dr. Green. Let's see.
Good
Dr.
afternoon,
Green.
Everyone. Good,
good
evening, everyone.
You.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. We hear you perfectly. Yes, ma'am. Thank
oh,
you so
great.
Much.
Good evening. Thank you, Sister Pam, for this
invitation. It's just a pleasure to be here, especially among these wonderful, wonderful guests. I look forward to this program, not so much talking about me, but let's just get to the subject of talking about these children and how they're in various systems and what we can do to ensure that our children are not caught up in systems, and those that are, what can we do to get them out of those systems?
Yes, ma'am. Beautiful. And you know what? So let me go ahead. I wanted to say that we talk about our children in the juvenile justice system, and that's why the title is saying United Our Efforts to Give Our Youth a Fair Chance. But I didn't want to just limit it to those who are in the system, because this problem impacts all of our youth. You know, our children are traumatized in these communities where their friends, where their relatives, where their selves are being racially profiled. You know, you got the stereotyping going on. So whether or not you're, you know, a graduate of the biggest HBCU in the country, you know, or you're a child who may not have those resources, this problem in the juvenile justice system impacts our children. And I really wanted to go way, way back with this, because we're going to look at some solutions. And we know, as Sister Judge Nichelle said, we got to make our own communities decent and safe places to live. One of the reasons why I say that is because this has historical this goes back historically. You know, some people will say the black family in modern slavery. That is some of what the scholars are talking about now. But I, you know, I always like a book by the name by an author by the name of Andrew Billingsley, and it's called Children of the Storm. And it talks about black children, and it goes back to how the system was not designed for us. And we're talking about 1830s. You know, we're talking about how the black child suffers more because rather than being taken care of in orphanages at that time, they put them in the lowest rung, which is the delinquent, and gave them the delinquent badge. So the system was originally designed with the child's deliberate exclusion at its very core. And so it could hardly be expected that as he has gradually been admitted into the total system, his entry would be equal in all respects. And I'm quoting Dr. Billingsley. He goes on to say that in the 1920s, you know, he summarized it by saying, putting all the information together, we can summarize that the placement of black children in the 1920s, they were largely excluded from child welfare institutions and left often received services prior to being labeled delinquent, and once so labeled, were more likely to be sent to prison. And in all sectors of the child placement system then, they were labeled as dependent or delinquent. Black children were victims of racist and discriminatory practices. You know, it goes on to talk about these misconceptions or these lies and these stereotypes that black families are not, black children have no parents. That's what he said. You know, these lies, these misconceptions that give rise to the targeting of our children. And then finally, I just wanted to quote Dr. Billingsley's position that this was in the 1890s. We've got Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois saying that schools constituted the most important tool in community efforts at social betterment after slavery. And so that brings us right up to the juvenile justice system now in the school-to-prison pipeline. You know, so because these schools that were not whites were not in school with us. We didn't have white teachers and, you know, these people, these police and all of this that are in these schools now. So after that historical perspective, I want to ask the question, you know, how do we see some of these problems? I know, Dr. Green, you did a dissertation on the punishment of youth in schools. Could you give us some opening on that, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought I was talking, but I had the phone on mute. But I think you can hear me now, right?
Yes, ma'am, perfectly.
Hello? Okay, great.
Yes, we hear you.
We have the Black Child Development Institute, so we nationally have some data. We do data on different states. Texas is one of the states that we did the data on to just kind of give a report card on I like to say, how are we faring? How are the children doing? Are they doing well within our systems? And, of course, you all probably can answer that question. But some of the things that we looked at would be the expulsion. And what we want to do is to end suspensions for young children. Because in Texas, black preschoolers are five times more likely than their white peers to receive an out-of-school suspension. And we found this information was during the 2015-2016 school year. It is still the same thing. Now, of course, because we had a period of time when children were not in school, then, you know, due to COVID, then that, of course, slowed some of that down. But we are still seeing some of that continue to rise even at this time. So we have to make sure that we pay attention to what's going on in these schools. We have some very good schools. But some of the things that happen, for example, our babies are also two times more likely to receive in-school, out-of-school suspension as well as in-school suspension. And so we want to look at what we can do to improve the health and wellness among Black children and their families, because we looked at other things such as comorbidities, and we also looked at the health and wellness among Black children in Texas. And so with that, we found that Black children are approximately two times more likely to live in low-income and food-insecure households than white children in the state of Texas. So those are just a few of the things that we've been looking at, and I will let someone else speak at this time.
This is Joanne, and if I can add to what Dr. Deborah said, I think also beyond the school, we have to look at the social deterrences of our community too as well, in regards to what economic drivers do we have, what's the housing look like in our community, because I think when we start to look at communities, and particularly when I think of Mount Vernon, we're surrounded by such communities that are affluent, that are very wealthy communities, and yet when you go a zip code into our community, we have to deal with some of the most poverty-stricken corridors of our community. And so I think we not only have to think about the school pipeline or what's happening in school, but we need to look at the social deterrences that are happening in our community and how they can be predictors or factors that cause involvement for our young people within the justice system. And sometimes these factors don't give our young people a fair chance, nor even a fighting chance.
Yes, ma'am.
May I say amen to that? Because there's one thing for sure that we also found out is that it shouldn't be this way, but if you're in certain zip codes, it was definitely a predictor of whether or not that child would be a part of the criminal justice system. So I just would like to say that's very, very true.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else want to delve into this topic? Because we want to make sure that we look at the mischaracterizations of the children who are in zip codes and, you know, throughout these countries, because the data for Texas is really the same throughout this country. And so I just kind of wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, and I just
if I could also take it from a different...
Go ahead, Dr. T. No. I just wanted to acknowledge the education that we're getting from our two sister scholars right here who are practitioners. And I just want to add and take it from a different perspective. You know, it's how we see determines what we see. You know, it's the way we see it will determine what we see. And I just want to take it from a different perspective because Joanne is doing the work, you know, as an executive director. She's implementing programs, and she is fighting each and every day. And I see the work, we see the work, but I want to take it from a different perspective that in order to do this work, you need the money. And I often say you can't have a mission without the money. Now, you can have the mission, but the mission will not be implemented if you do not have the funding. And when we look at the zip codes, and the dearths and the lack thereof for our children. It is really incumbent, it's really important for us to understand access and opportunity. And that's where I step in and I fill the gap. And I use my resources, I use my Rolodex, and I leverage my access to bring about opportunity. And what that means is, as Black women, we must understand the importance of funding our organizations, funding Joanne's organization and all of the organizations that are out here doing the work. And that means we must have that are in control of the budget and that are in control of leveraging opportunity and providing and finding the funding that will allow Joanne to do the work that she needs to do. So I just want to bring that perspective.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Dr. Tracy said it so well, because not even from the funding to do the work. This is Joanne. I'm going to be jumping in probably all night because I see it every day. And Dr. T can tell you, along with Judge Michelle, not even from the factors of funding the agency, but when you look at the young people and their encounters within the justice system, you can tell who has the economic drivers to fight the system versus who doesn't. And there already you see the drivers that are going to happen, because right in the courthouse you can see the ones that have the means to pay for a paid attorney versus those who don't. And then those who have that means, you can see that there's more mitigation that happens. There's more things that kind of spill out. And so you start to see this as well. And you get before the courts. And sometimes I have to tell you, I have left the courthouse in tears, because I have had young Black people who have sold drugs. And yet they say this young kid is going to prison and he's only 18 years of age. And so your heart aches, because you understand why this young person has served, sold some drugs, because it was by any means necessary in their environment to live and to survive. And so sometimes it's a hard fight. But like Tracy said, trying to fund the work, trying to also fund how do we provide the resources so that when these young people are intertwined in it, how do they make sure they're getting the right response and the right, like equitable practices and processes. And that's a real hard, hard piece. And I know Judge Johnson could jump in here and definitely speak to it, but I think Tracy says it so well, that it's not just funding the work, but funding and really disrupting the work. Because if you really go back to the historical context of particularly like prosecution, it's built on racism, right? It's built on a history of racism. And so trying to change a prosecutor's mind and trying to really educate them on the young person beyond the crime, that's a whole piece of work that needs to be done. And sometimes they not necessarily want to hear that. So trying to fund not only the work you're doing to try to change the lives of young people, but trying to fund the work just to be advocates and really, how do you, you know, get people to look at a different perspective and change the culture of the justice system. And it's so hard. It is so hard.
Let me jump in here, Sister Pamela, very quickly. In the court system. So what's my role, knowing this reality of there being a disparity in, you know, someone who can afford an outside attorney and someone who cannot? Most of our children, our young people, our young adults. One of the things that we do in the court system, we assign 18B lawyers, which are lawyers who take on the responsibility of handling cases where the person cannot afford to pay an outside attorney. And the state will pay these attorneys to represent these folks. So as a judge, knowing that, we have to make sure, and what we do make sure, and I hope I've been doing a good job of this, is that those 18B attorneys who are private attorneys are doing the work. God rest his soul, Judge Edwards is a judge who just passed away not too long ago, but I recall he was one of the senior judges. He was a senior judge in my courthouse. He just passed away a week and a half ago as well. But
one of the things that he was staunch about. I mean, if there was an attorney on that 18B panel that did not have the expertise to represent the people in court, he would not assign that attorney. And so I think as a judge, knowing what we know about the disparity in income and who can afford, and usually the people that can afford the private attorney, we have an obligation to make sure that those 18B lawyers that are assigned are doing the work. And we do that. There's not a day that doesn't go by that I'm not chastising or telling someone, well, you know, counsel, are you doing a mitigation package, beloved? You know, and I'll say it. Every now and again, that's overstepping my bounds. I'm the judge. But at the same time, you know, the lawyer is representing someone in my court that can't afford one, but they're going to get good representation nonetheless, because I got to sign the timesheet that's going to pay that attorney the money that they make. And so they have to perform. And so with judges like that, we can try to help in this process of bringing things full circle, where someone that doesn't have the ability to have an outside attorney does have an 18B lawyer that's going to work hard, because the judge is making sure that they're doing what they have to do. And I know I do that on a daily basis. And I know Judge Edwards, rest his soul, he was the first one that said to me, I don't give a damn who's in the courtroom. If that guy, he doesn't have the ability to represent them, I'm not assigning him to this case, because he doesn't do a good job. And that was the first I heard of that we can just all praises due to Allah. Yes, ma'am, money is so important. But as Joanne said, sometimes we ain't got it. And the appointed attorneys are going to have to work hard, especially in my court where I know better, and forever judge or whatever judge is cognizant, I'm hoping that they're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And I get honored, Michelle Johnson, Judge Michelle Muhammad, because you do exactly that. You make sure that we look at the whole person, and you make sure that we have, and I have to say this because you say you got to give people their flowers while they can smell them. And Judge Michelle does exactly that. She might say she oversteps her boundaries, but when I tell you she is a woman that extends grace to these young people and to anyone that is in her court, and she makes sure that they are connected to the right attorney, and she makes sure that we have a conference to make sure that we have implemented the appropriate treatment plan for that young person to ensure that they're connected not only to, because courts are looked at usually as a punitive nature, right? We always are quick to correct and do a punitive action, but if we're really talking about restorative justice, Judge Johnson, Judge Michelle Johnson Muhammad, however you want to call her, she is a woman that really makes sure that we look at the whole person, and that at the end of the day, we're providing restorative justice to really transform the lives of people, so that they're not, her courtroom does not become a revolving door, but a door that really transforms the lives of individuals. So I really just had to give her her flowers while we're here.
Yeah. Oh, praise be to Allah. Applause.
Yes, ma'am.
And what I'm hearing, on the line tonight, I'm hearing from women who are warriors, and I'm really want to bring the attention to how we move in our places and spaces, because we all know this work is daunting. It is difficult. It's challenging. And we have all shed many tears. I know for sure just some of the conversations, you know, I've been privileged to have with some of the women on this call. I say that to say, when we step into our position, we're going to have to really, really strap up, boot up, and really start to be courageous. And that's what I was hearing from Judge Michelle, too, when Joanne was speaking of her work. We're going to have to start taking on a much more courageous attitude and understand that we are the people that are going to save our nation, our children. And I say that because it's not easy, right? It's not easy to do this work. And it really is not, particularly when we have people who may not agree with our the way we think, right? They may not agree, or they may have different perceptions and perspectives. But I just want to remind us that we're going to have to be and continue to be warriors, very similar to our Viola Davis, the way she was a warrior in The Woman King. And I just want to remind us and just, that's it. I'm done.
Right. And, you know, and praise so God. This is, it's important that we are courageous and we look at things, you know, in a perspective. Our show is here to educate the public as to what's going on, what we see. And one thing we do see is the criminalization of black youth. And what I started off by reading the history of the juvenile justice system, I think was partly to show that a system that has been operating such as this since slavery, and you see the same types of cyclical behavior. You still see black youth being overrepresented in their population. You know, we still see the same poverty. It was called almshouses. You know, we've got to look at how those who don't have money can be better served by perhaps, you know, some of the volunteerism. And on our call, we often talk about making our community safe places to live. And we also talk sometimes about removing our children from these institutions. And we also talk about sometimes that there is no real solution to the problem of the races. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad has told us that separation is really the solution to this. And again, you know, we're here tonight bringing different thoughts and mindsets. But again, when we look at the continuation and the cyclical nature, for example, and that's why I brought up schools, because I think criminal codes of conduct in schools, and Sister Judge Nichelle, you can add to us, and I'm sure you see it as well, Ms. Dunn, where you see juveniles being criminalized by behavior they may do in schools, such as disorderly conduct, you know, criminalizing youth for childlike behavior, like throwing something in the trash can. I've got a exhibit here, children common student behaviors leading to school arrest. This came from the ACLU. Spraying perfume, fake burping, refusing to change a T-shirt. Kicking a trash can, throwing a paper airplane, science experiment. You know, 5-year-old with ADHD had a tantrum, taking a milk carton. And so when we look at the trauma that these children are experiencing, and then they become older and older, and we see this behavior being played out in communities. And, you know, do we really get what's going on to our children? They're being bullied, you know, and so what do we do about that? One of the questions I had was, what do you think children need? Sister Nichelle, did you want to talk to us about some of these times in your court where you see very trivial tickets, level offenses, infractions being penalized in criminal court systems for behavior in school?
Absolutely. Behavior in school or a young person, I guess the worst I ever saw was someone being arrested for stealing a candy bar. And I mean, literally, it was a case in my court, which was outrageous. And so, yes, ma'am, we do see the minor things. And part of the problem with that is that once a child has been identified as doing something at the school, they will literally suspend them from the school. And the problem with that is that there aren't services. Usually those children are missing out because they don't have the services for them when they exclude them from the school for whatever behavior it is, as trivial as it may be. So one of the things I started to do when I was a judge there, I wouldn't allow the suspension. I told him, you're going to figure out how to let this child go to school, and either if it was a fight with somebody else, keep them separated, but you're going to figure it out, because I'm not making them leave that school and then for a month and they don't even have the services. So, yeah, the most trivial of things, children fight, you know, they get into a fight with one another at the school. One child is arrested, whoever may have started the fight, or maybe they both are. and then they're both suspended, and then they suffer because educationally we don't have the systems in place to make sure that the tutors are available, that the schooling that they're going to get now that they're out of school is really happening. And so I stopped doing it. And I just did that. As the judge, I said, I'm not doing it anymore. I'm not suspending them. You might as well figure it out, school. That's what you get paid for. You're going to figure out how these children are going to go to class. And just because they had a fight, I'm not taking them out of the school like that. It's not going to happen. So, yes, ma'am, I do see it. And it's terrible because it has this ripple effect of not only criminalizing something that everyone may get into a fight, something may happen, you know, but now it's a ripple effect that they can't even learn now. Now you disrupt their entire educational studies because now they can't go to school anymore. You're supposed to have
right.
services, but I've seen those services not even kick in for a month or 2 months. The child is literally home with no school at all. So, yes, ma'am, but how do I combat that? I don't do it. And I don't give a damn what nobody thinks. I don't do it.
Yeah.
The school is going to figure out how to have all those children in there and keep them apart, and that's what they're going to have to do.
Yes.
Well, yes,
thank
ma'am.
You for that. I'm going to go ahead and open up the mic. If anyone has a question or a comment and they would like to ask a question or make a comment, press the number 1 to get into the host queue for a question or a comment. Let's see, I have a caller, 682 is your last caller.
Yes. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Yes, ma'am, Sister Pamela. As I listened to the ladies, I thought about my elementary and school experiences and how I was so surprised when I moved to Detroit to discover that many of the programs that we had, including gym, which removed a lot of the frustration that children would have. We had home economics cooking classes and sewing classes. All of those have been taken off the agenda. And these things that they have taken out of the school and they took the money and did something else with it, it shows you their lack of concern for Black children. Yes, ma'am. So as I listen
yes,
to the ladies, I realize that there has the one solution to these children is because we are a group of us at one of my educational leadership. We did a project to how we could improve school activity, and one of the things we did was to talk about the children doing gardening, the children doing gym classes and other things to eliminate frustration. All of these things have been taken out of the educational agenda in many schools. Thank you for letting me share.
Yes, ma'am. No, that's a really good point. Thank you. Thank you for that. Because actually there's an article in the Final Call, and it's entitled Solutions to Police and Community Violence Needs an All-Hands-on-Deck Approach. And it went into, you know, the targeting of policing and its impact on primarily young people. And when we look at children going to school, and that's one of the places where they should be fostering a love of learning, and they're actually being targeted, this is really, you know, a root problem. And one of the things they brought up in this article is what is called, broken windows. It's called broken windows policing. It comes from the ideology that by, ticketing people, punishing level acts of civil disorder like drinking alcohol and homelessness and sleeping on the sidewalk or something, that is a way to reduce more serious crimes. So this was something that came out in 1982 in the Atlantic Monthly. This is an article by William P. Muhammad. But what we see, it doesn't work. The strategy is it's actually causing more harm because we know this is how Michael Brown, you know, who was walking down the street you know, got pulled over. This is how our children are targeted, and this is happening right in their very schools. And so, again, I think this is something that we brought it up. It's a juvenile justice issue, and I just really wanted to, you know, just kind of put it out there for a conversation, because this is the lowest level of what the juvenile justice system is doing to youth, but it probably has some of the worst ramifications, because we know prison beds are built on, what is that, fourth grade reading scores. So did anyone want to have anything they wanted to say about that? You know, because, again, I think Sister Ula brought up a really good conversation that we can probably all get together on. And this is this issue about how the false representation that Black children don't have family. You know, we know that the Monahan Report, I didn't know that, but this is in the 70s. There was a report done, and it showed, you know, that Black families were just horrible. This is what this report falsely said. However, that wasn't true, because according to the 1970 census, Black families had two parents, you know, 60 to 95% of Black families. That's according to the census. And so at that time, you know, but these same myths and perpetrated lies about our families not being good enough, and we, you know, need to be torn apart, children being accused of super predators. I mean, this is behavior that I think we have to look at and try to unite our efforts to give our youth a fair chance. Because, you know, some people say nobody's going to help us but ourselves. And does anybody have any thoughts? Sister Deborah?
This is Joanne. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm learning how to do this radio show online on my phone. But I would say you're so right in regards to how they will misperceive the Black family. And I think that one of the things that we have gotten, at least with the shelter, is that even if there's some issues or concerns with the biological family of a young person, we're their family. And I think that that's where we have to unite more as a community, because, you know, for us, by us, in essence, in regards to if we're going to really make change and we're going to really impact the system and impact the lives of these young people, the family unit has to go beyond just the biological structure. And we have to unite to really cause some friction, because I think what's happening is sometimes as a mom or as a dad, you don't know the strength that you have, or sometimes you're tapped out trying to fight a system alone by yourself. And so I think when you unite with other forces and entities, you become a bigger unit, a bigger mechanism that can mobilize your impact, maximize your footprint. And so I would say in this vein, and I think, you know, the work that we're doing at the youth shelter and with Dr. T and Dr., you know, and Judge Michelle, is one of the things is that we're bridging family beyond the biological structure, and we're redefining what family is, because society will say it's a certain look, it's a certain image, it's a certain, you know, description, but we have the ability to design it the way we want to. And so, you know, I'm the executive director for the youth shelter, but every time I have a young person that lives in my residence that goes to court, I show up at court. And so the judges know if that family member doesn't speak, I want to go on the record. Joanne wants to go on the record for our young person. And I think that that's so critical, because many a time the family doesn't know their power or their strength or their concern about elevating their voice and not having the undergirding of others to support them. And so when I think about the family structure, we have to come together to really redefine family and really bridge community into that. And that's really how we unite for a time for justice and make a bigger footprint in regards to disrupting what's happening in our communities.
That's right. Beautiful.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Wow. Yes.
It goes
and,
back.
And while we...
Go ahead, Trey.
No, no, I just wanted to say, I'm just hanging on every word that's being said here. And it just, it also brings me to think about and to share, understand the system and the economics behind it, right? You know, the currency, because everything is about currency, right? And as we're talking about the system, and I have the air quotes, we all know that the system is about currency. And when we educate our families and we help them to understand the historical perspective, right? And then we start to help them understand that every time our child is arrested, every time our child is suspended, that's going to equal currency, and it's making someone else wealthier. And I think when we start to really educate our families and our youth to help them understand, there's a dollar sign to us not succeeding, us going to jail, us doing what is going to help someone else become wealthier. I think it also changes the narrative, because we start to take a little bit more control over our walk. And I just wanted to put that out there, that we need to begin to educate our communities and our people and our parents and our youth.
No, I agree. Thank you so much for that. Sister Deborah, did you want to talk about this? Because you were featured this week in an article in the Houston Sun about, I think you talked about wraparound services, the importance of family. I think, can you come on in on into this part of the conversation, sis?
Yes, I was just thinking as everyone was talking, it really is about perception, how we perceive ourselves and how others perceive our babies. And I was just thinking about the fact that in Texas, the elementary school, some children as young as 4 years old are suspended. They're sent to alternative schools and expelled at rates that you wouldn't believe. And I think that, again, it's really about how do we see ourselves and how do others see us. And we have to dispel some of the myths that are out there. And one that was brought up is, I agree that it is definitely a myth that there is not a father or a male presence in the home. You know, this term single parent, it almost leads people to believe that a parent had this child without another parent, but it takes two. Now, what that involvement is one thing. And also I look at children also have sometimes, it may not be a father, but there could be other role models within the family. It could be an uncle. It could be a grandfather. So we need to look at the family in a different way. And I think that's what the sister was just talking about. We need to redefine and restructure for ourselves according to what we believe and what we believe our family. I mean, I personally was raised by my grandmother. And my mother had several siblings, and so aunts and uncles, all of them, I believe, had a part in raising me. And I appreciated that, and that was my family. So I think that we have to really understand that family could be different for different people, but it's all about how you care for one another and what love you bring into the situation for those children that are in the family. Another thing, too, is that there are myths out there about how we as Black people care for our children, that we don't necessarily care for them properly. That is not always the case. A lot of the things that we see going on is based on racism, and that racism is reflected in disproportionality in that we see more Black children in the system. But that does not mean that we don't love our children or that we're not good parents. So I just wanted to bring that up, that sometimes data tells the story, but we need to understand what that story is and who is telling the story, because we need to tell the story for ourselves. a lot of times there is poverty involved as well. And with the poverty, sometimes husbands are not involved in the family, or they are, but they're somewhere in the back room somewhere because of the poverty, and then they're trying to make sure their family eats and that the food, you know, is very important. So to qualify for things like food stamps and different things like that, I'm using an old term because I don't think they call it food stamps anymore, but you guys know what I'm talking about. There are certain qualifications that we don't meet if we don't have certain characteristics. If you have two parents in the family, then there's a certain income threshold that you have to look at. So it's just a whole lot of different things systemically that have created throughout the years this disproportionality that we see and that we continue to see today.
Yeah.
And I wanted to jump in really quickly, Sister Pamela.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead. Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead, sis. Go ahead. I just wanted to say, I've always loved that saying, it takes a village to raise a child, because that's in fact true. And I think what Dr. Green and all of the panelists have been saying, and Joanne Dunn, about the extended family. You know, I know they say we don't have a family unit, but as long as we remember that we have a role to play, and by God's permission, we're going to do it. I think the minister says it best. You can't serve a people unless you love them. And I could say truly,
that's
you
right.
can tell with Dr. Green and Dr. Alexander and Joanne Dunn that they love the community because they can serve it well. And we have an obligation where the family unit may be cut, as Joanne sees in a lot of the cases, that they step in. And wherever they are, those folks become her family. And I could truly say that I've seen her treat the people this way, the young youth that are in her shelter. They feel loved. They feel like they have a family. And so we no longer are going to take the dictate from anyone telling the family is only that mother and father. We understand our role to extend it, that it takes a village to raise a child and to give it its love. And as long as there's love, we can, you know, do something for these young people while we can. And so I just wanted to share that. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. And you know what? I've been doing this a long time. I've been doing this for over 30 years, being an advocate for Black youth in the system. And I have to be honest as an attorney and say that I have not seen the condition of our youth getting better in terms of being incarcerated, in terms of Black youth being placed into adult jails, in terms of children aging out of foster care, in terms of our children being, you know, just exploited. There was a young man who, you know, it happens all the time in cities, but this young man was disabled, like a 19-year-old, put into an adult jail here in Harris County. He was beat to a pulp. You know, we know the judge in Pennsylvania who has been, you know, charged and convicted of this, Children for Cash programs. You know, we got a judge down in another part of Texas who, because now during the pandemic, they're doing a lot of Zoom. So, you know, the joke was is that they were putting these Black children, well, these children in the juvenile justice system on YouTube. And people were actually kind of looking at it like a reality show. And so I think one of the perspectives we have to look at is, is our focus on how to solve some of these problems, do we need to really look at some different avenues instead of the same old avenues we've been looking at over, you know, over the years, because it's only getting worse. I know with the Congress, there's a place where you can file charges, because there are some protections that the juvenile code or the Justice Department says, well, if youth are being housed in facilities and it's too many of them, or, you know, certain infractions are going on, you can file a charge. But we know oftentimes those investigations happen, but they don't really glean any kind of results. And our children are getting, you know, sometimes the condition is not improving in terms of us having hand-to-hand contact with them. you know, us thinkers, us movers and shakers, us people with the money, as Sister Dr. Tracy brought up. And so, again, just want to make a quote from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He said, you're trying to force yourself into white society rather than take the responsibility of building your own. And reminds me of a joke once. I was at a big conference, and they did a big presentation on how to solve the problem of disproportionality, which everybody knows that's, you know, black people are represented in systems higher than our population. We are 13%, but we might be 26% in jails or special education and removing from homes. You know, we're just overrepresented. And so they were talking about how they want to fix it. And so I looked at the presentation, sound good, but then I kind of raised my hand. I said, well, maybe, you know, you all could give us the money and we could fix it ourselves. And you know what? That was not third solution by some of the stakeholders who were, you know, representing some of the nonprofits in the room. So I think, again, we've got to look at how can we be part of the solutions. That's, you know, that's just a thought for me.
Yeah.
So.
If I can jump in here, too, and I just, you know, and I speak on a very hyper-local effort in regards to the youth shelter and the work that we're doing, because we're technically the only alternative to incarceration program in New York State that is for emerging adults ages 18 to 24, 25. And so I say this, and I come from a lens of that, one, if we're the only in New York State, we already have a problem, right? So, you know, one of the things that I think that I have learned in this field, and I've only been in this work for the last 2 years. I started in 2020, and, you know, I really came from a youth development lens, and so I really don't have no experience in law, you know, the justice system, or, you know, just working with people returning home from incarceration. But being in this work at the youth shelter, it has taught me that, one, we can't arrest our way to a better future, and that if we don't really invest in communities and really invest in people, we are going to continue to be in a circumstance that we're in. And also that if we don't really focus on the communities that are directly impacted by over criminalization or over policing or, you know, or disproportionality. And so for me, the work at the youth shelter has been eye-opening in regards to, like, you knew racism was embedded in the work, but now being in it for the past 2 years, it's eye-opening, right? And I say that because, you know, I learned that I'm so, you know, and you all know this, being in the justice system, like my work at the shelter in regards to the alternative to incarceration and diversion comes as a post-arrest kind of situation. For me, it has been so important for me, particularly as a black woman, as a mother who's raising three children, two of my children who are adopted. It has been particularly important for me to get into the work before they get arrested, because that's when, if we can find the drivers of why young people are even coming into, you know, the pipeline, or why young people are being, you know, caught up in the system in regards to, you know, from school or from the communities, how do we get there and how do we do our work? And I say that because for me, one of the work that I've recently got involved in was really prosecution, right? And really looking at how do we reshape prosecution, because prosecutors, their role always has been on evaluating the crime and not the person. And so we are now in this work where we're working with the Vera Institute, which is a national institute, to really reform prosecution and really look at how we look at those kind of what they call quote unquote being tough on crime kind of attacks that they do. And it really, it continues to marginalize a certain subset of the population, which is black and brown folks, young people, because they're tough on crime with them because they don't have the resources to fight. And so for us at the youth shelter, it has become very eye-opening that we have to get in this full circle to understand that we have to address the systematic racial disparities, We have to look at our community that is directly impacted, and how do we elevate the voices, and how do we disrupt what's happening there, and then how do we also come in to make sure that we're providing alternative approaches so that young people can still be young people and actually dare to think about their future and where they're going, and not just be punished and punitive in regards to, you know, for the crime, but how do we get them to think about their lives beyond that? And so I say that because I hear you ladies loud and clear. And for me, I know it's small, but, you know, I feel like if I don't get involved in the why and the how, the what we're doing right now, it won't matter. And I don't want to run youth jails for another 40 years. And so I feel like it's so critical when you talk about a time for justice and uniting our efforts, we're at this time that we have to disrupt, destroy, and dismantle what is happening.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That is so beautiful. I hear you, sister. Thank you so much for that.
Amen. I just had to come off of mute and just take it in for a moment.
Yeah, because, you know, in this article, and again, it's talking about broken windows, the system where you just penalize people for the little bitty things they do on the street trying to prevent other stuff, and we know that doesn't work, right? But it says the passion should be directed. This student minister, he's saying that the passion should be directed more toward exposing the enemy, you know, while breathing life into the youth by letting them know who they are based upon what Allah God said about them. He said, if we can get them to see and then believe in the divine in themselves, they will begin to know what is best for them. And then I thought it was so interesting as you were talking, sis, because another quote, and I think this is so important, Judge Nichelle, you know how we feel. It says, the eternal leader of the Nation of Islam, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, said that in teaching a man, one teaches an individual. But through teaching a woman, one is teaching a nation. And the wisdom of his teachings extend beyond race, ethnicity, social station, or faith tradition. You know, and here we go back to that woman, because, you know, nobody has the type of, you know, energy or passion than a mother and her child and her children. And many of these are, this community is our, they're our children. So someone else want to have any thoughts on what we're talking about here? Yeah, because I thought, like Sister Ula said again, I'm going to go back to her call. She talked about children playing. And this is such a wake-up call for me, because when I came into the juvenile system, into law as a youngster, 20-something years old, out of a black community, one of the things that really disturbed me was to see young children incarcerated who were, you know, for playing. You know, we knew that our children – They're children. They're being incarcerated for childlike behavior. They're being, and this was not what we grew up with. And so I think again, this is somewhat unfair. You know, black youth are portrayed in the media as being bad, and I know Ms. Sister Alexander, Dr. Tracy, you kind of know how the media, you know, probably has some tendency to, you know, cover some of the worst stories sometimes for black children, that's for sure. So,
Oh, too well.
Thank
I
you.
Know. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
And so, you know, just to talk about the media, and we have to be mindful and thoughtful. And I often, you know, I have the joy of teaching what I know. And that's journalism. So I make sure I just share the little bit of knowledge that's been imparted in me. And we have to pay attention to certain words that surround our youth, right? Certain words when we're watching the news, right? We got to pay attention. Because if we pay attention just the way the stories are written,
and how they unfold, it gives you a peek into the minds of people who are perhaps writing the story. So when you talk about the media, that's a whole other show. We just have to be mindful of the images and the stories surround our youth, and that help you know, perpetuate this narrative that our youth are you know, wild and out of control, or you know, all of these negative images. We've got to start to pay attention and begin to question, and not only question, demand action. And I say this is a whole other show. This is a whole other show. But when we hear and we see things that are not right, and we know they're not right, we got to start picking up the phone and start saying, you know what, I'm turning the channel. I'm not watching that newscast. I'm going to pick up the phone. I'm going to call the general manager. Never mind that. I'm just calling the news station and let them know, you know what, we may need to correct that. And I've done that before, and I encourage my students to start doing that. So I don't want to go on for the tangent, but when you start about the media, we have to start to become a little bit more responsible of what we are hearing and allowing people to tell us.
Yes, ma'am.
I think,
you're right.
Yeah, I think, and yes, ma'am, that's right, Sister Tracy, that it's a big deal, that media piece, and we know it, right? In the nation, we always talk about the images and stuff that they put out, and that there's an agenda on why it's that
an
way.
An agenda, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's terrible that in this day and this time, 2022, we're still talking about Joanne Dunn being the only one youth shelter that we can talk about, you know, being the only or being the first in anything at this point is just really sad when you think about it, right? But I think it goes back to, you know, what we believe in the nation. We can do as much as we can, and we're trying. And I think all of the sisters on this call and, you know, and brothers and sisters, we're trying to make that impact and make a difference, but not sure if it's enough. You understand? Because we're still suffering, even in this day and age, we're still seeing the first of its kind program, the first person to do this, the first black person to do that. That's really sad when you think about it, but it still goes back to the theory and the concept of separation. And I think we applaud the sisters and brothers who are out there on the front lines trying to do the work. But at the end of the day, when you look at the time, and we're still doing it for the first time, and we're still suffering, it shows you that perhaps we're not going to be able to solve this in this dispensation of time. And we're going to have to go into our own coffers and shut down as a community what we know is going on. And that's going to come sooner than later as far as we're concerned here in the nation. But I'll leave it on that note. Yes, ma'am, Sister Pamela.
Yes, ma'am. And I mean, and I hear you, but, you know, but I'm going to quote the minister and say that the Minister Farrakhan has been consistent voice calling for black people to work with one another across cultural, religious, and political lines to address the critical problems in our communities, particularly when it comes to violence inflicted on one another. The minister has warned, our war is not on one front, our war is on two fronts, the Muslim leader explained. Those of us who are so quick to shed the blood of our own brothers, our own sister, and then he says, we can't go to Washington to address the government's evil and not address the evil that we're doing for one another. And he says, you know, this demands all of us as stakeholders to come back into our community and address what needs to be addressed to curb the violence that has not only gone on inside our communities, but is going on throughout the United States of America. Fratricidal conflict, the minister explained. And so, for me, I think we've never been united as a people since, you know, things like integration. You know, we were brought here in chattel slavery. We don't know who we are. You know, we feel many times that we are still begging for solutions. And I think this turning where we're starting to look at each other, you know, to solve our problems, this brother in this article, He's a Chicago-based non-for-profit called Violence Interrupters, and his name is T.O. Hardiman. He's the president. And he said that, that educating black, brown, and low-income youth first requires gaining their trust. He said this must be done before any effective messaging can reach them, but he said it's easier to facilitate change because he says the reality is that we've been divided, and that's really the point. You know, so we know, everybody knows about Willie Lynch, we've heard it, but I think any time the media, for example, was allowed to demonize our youth and make them super predators, we can see straight on that in the 90s, our community was very much divided as to whether or not our youth, you know, were salvageable. You know, and so that's one of the issues, the old being divided against the young and the poor against the wealthy. But I started off by saying that uniting our efforts to give our youth a fair chance, that goes for youth in the juvenile justice system as well as youth who are you know, supposedly not at risk. Because really we're all one people, you know, black people. We all are going to be kind of lumped into that one group of black people. And we're not going to get out of this unless we unite. You know, we've been doing this since we were brought here, being disunited. And me personally, I can't stand to see our children being victimized and targeted and, you know, stereotyped. Scapegoated and not look at the solutions that, you know, we have to make our own communities decent and safe places to live. So that, you know, I just kind of wanted to throw it out there.
And Sister Pam, I agree with you. And I think, too, like, you know, one thing just coming from a youth lens that young people, and I think you said it, the gentleman from the Violence Interrupt, that one, we have to first authentically engage people before we can get to building up young people because they have to gain our trust. And I think that that's where we kind of sometimes have lost our young people because sometimes, you know, and I come from an old school era, even though I think I'm 21 in my head, I come from an old school era where it was children were to be seen and not heard, right? And only spoke when, you know, speak when spoken to. And I think our young people have now revolted in essence because our young people, they have more wit. And the Bible talks about being weaker and wiser, but our young people are wiser than us now. And our young people, they need a chance to elevate their voices, and they don't come from an angle in regards to who's just as involved versus who's not just involved. When they see young people, they see young people. And I think that we, if we're going to unite, I think as we unite, we have to also make sure that we create safe spaces for our young people to truly, truly be their authentic self and to give a big, deepest, darkest, or, you know, or inner thoughts and secrets, because I think at times our young people are, even in their communities, are sometimes scared to be their true self because of what the, repercussions may be. And I just wanted to add that because as I continue to work with young people, my biggest thing is that every day I want you to show up and be your authentic self. Because if you can't show up in the world and be your authentic self, you'll always be played by somebody else's strings. And so it's so important, and because many times we as practitioners, we want so much for our young people, or we're crafting a road for them, and yet we haven't allowed them to build that boat for themselves. And we have to make sure that they understand that they're captain of their ship and that we are there to undergird them and to support them. And so just want to make sure I really say that, because young people need more and more of a space to decompress and to really be a true authentic self.
And I agree with that 100%. And Sister Pam, I would also like to add that we need to really think about young people but are of babies. I mean, in Texas, you know, some kids as young as 4 years old are suspended, and they're sent to alternative schools. That's in Texas. And so we need to really take care of all of the children at each age. So when we start thinking about them in terms of interventions, it's not just teenagers or preschool kids, preteens, but babies. Our babies are also under attack, and that's something that we didn't get a chance to really talk about. But we know that African-American students make up about 13% of elementary school population in Texas, but they account for 47% of all pre-K through prevention. And so, I mean, maybe that's something for another show, but it's really important that we look at all aspects of this as well.
Oh, true.
No, you are so right, sis. And again, these oppressive systems, there's a report written, Liberate the Black Family, and this is from Family Policing System, and this is by Angela Burton and Joyce McMillan, because there are scholars who are starting to talk about this and the punishment and the slavery and, you know, the false narratives, how it's the same thing. Nothing has changed. And so I think you bring up a great point, Deborah, about how they come at our children as young as possible so as to potentially not have to, be fair. You know, this whole eugenicist policies and some of these other policies, depopulation agendas, we talk about these things. And I wanted to say to you, Sister Joanne, that's such a beautiful comment you made. I want to read again. I got to go to the final call, August 30th. But we had an article by Michael Z. Muhammad I would encourage you to read. It's called Passing the Torch and Preparing Future Generations for Leadership. You know, we talk about the Joshua generation. That was on the front page, cover of a final call, I think, a couple weeks ago, because the minister says, and I'm going to quote him, he says, our young people, are the strongest, most powerful generation that we have ever produced since our fathers were brought to these shores as slaves. He said, you are greatly misunderstood, not only by your elders, but oftentimes by your parents. He said, we produced this generation, and we cannot deny what we have produced. They are different from us. He said, they are not hope. They are fulfillment. He said, but when the thing that is hoped for comes along, sometimes we are not prepared for what we hope for. And that's the minister, Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, in a lecture entitled, Our Youth, the Most Powerful Generation We Produced Since Slavery. And that's July 17th, 1993, when he did that. So, ladies, we are actually down to like the 5 minute mark, and our show was entitled United Our Efforts to Give Our Youth a Fair Chance. And I think we had different perspectives, but we all were on the same page of trying to help Black youth, strengthen Black families, lift some of this real life criminalization of our youth that is going on. We've talked about school policies. You know, you all shared with us some of the wonderful resources and efforts that you make to be on the battlefield for our youth, and I can't thank you enough. That's Dr. Tracy Alexander, Dr. Sister Joanne Dunn, Miss Joanne Dunn, and, of course, Sister Judge Michelle and Deborah Green, Dr. Deborah Green. So, anybody want to close out? We're down. Judge Michelle, did you want to close out? Dr. Judge Michelle Muhammad, did you want to close out for us?
Yes, ma'am. Get it right now. Get it right now.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Listen, it's been a wonderful talk with these sisters here who are doing the work, who are wise and brought something to it. I certainly learned a little bit more here about, you know, the fact that we still have a lot of work to do. And, you know, all I could say is, you know, God is in the details. And so at every level that we're at, we have a role and responsibility. And I think the panelists this evening are doing what they see fit to help in this dispensation of time of trying to make sure that our youth
are taken care of and that the system is as fair as it can be. And so I want to thank the sisters for their beautiful work, for everything that they do, and to remind the audience that when the masses of our people are still suffering, we still have a lot of work to do. And we're clear about that. And so I thank the sisters for their work. And I know I'm going to continue to do what I can from my vantage point. And we all have a role to play. And I think we're trying the best that we can. So all praise is due to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. Did any other sisters want to close out? Thank you all again for taking your personal time, your valuable time, and coming on to share with us this knowledge. Did anyone have a closing remark, give any information how they could be reached? I don't know. Does anyone have a closing remark?
I just want to say thank you again, Sister Pam, for inviting me to be on this panel. It's been very enlightening, and I really appreciate the information that was shared here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you. Thank you. I just want to say thank you and just want to remind every woman on this panel tonight that you are the woman king. And as we leave, keep it in your heart and in your mind and in your soul. We are the woman king. Let's do the work. Thank you. Thank you, Sister Michelle, for the invitation.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank
absolutely.
You, Dr. Alexander. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So, and all right. Well, that I want to say thank you all for listening to the Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice. To hear previous shows, you can log on to Blog Talk Radio, The Elevated Places. We invite you to visit the website of our sister, Dr. Minister Ava Muhammad, at ministerava.com. And we also would like to thank our team, and that's Sister Judge Michelle Muhammad. Thank you again for being a co-host. I thank you so much, Sister Tiffany Muhammad, who is a producer. And also we have Sister Samaya Muhammad, who is also my producer. I want to thank you all, the listeners, for calling in. Thank you once again for listening, and ask you to tune in next week for more informative discussions. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you.
Wa alaikum salam, family. Have a good night. Thank you, sisters.
Good night.
Love you all.
Thank you, Jack.
Have a beautiful, beautiful night. Continue to work. We love you and everything you're doing for our people. All praise to you for our lives.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, sister.
Good night.
Good night.